Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And today, Adam will be talking with New York Times bestselling health and medical writer Ann Fletcher about her new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction. Looking forward to this really important conversation that may offer some hope for a treatment that can help people.
Well, and also some pitfalls to avoid, because I think we hear this daily from our patients and our loved ones and our own families, and sometimes we don't know where to turn. Maybe have some answers today. But first, Christy, we got some really interesting research that matters about the effects of exercise and maybe avoiding dementia as you get older.
About the patient-centered medical home and a review of whether it's beneficial or not so far.
Some research suggesting that maybe the risk of CAT scans isn't as great as the benefits, and Christy and I may or may not agree.
And finally, some research suggesting that baby boomers may live longer than their parents, but that their elders were healthier.
Well, let's jump right in about exercise and dementia. And Christy, we've done a lot of research on your health that talks about the benefits of exercise, and we've done a fair amount of research and discussion about ways of helping people cope with, maybe prevent dementia, particularly Alzheimer's. Here, this study combines the two.
It does, and we really know very little about effective prevention strategies for dementia, and it's something that's scary for a lot of people, certainly scary for my parents, thinking, what if that, you know, is something that happens to them? So this is a study looking at a relationship between those two things, fitness levels in midlife and all causes of dementia in advanced age.
Yeah, this was actually research that was supported by the American Heart Association, and it looked at almost 20,000 people who had a baseline fitness examination, then followed them up over time to see how many of them developed dementia and could see the relationship between that fitness and the development of that dementia, which was actually a good thing. The more you exercised and the more fit you were, the less you got dementia.
And it's true that higher midlife fitness levels not only protected or had lower relationship with all causes of dementia, it wasn't just that it was the ones due to stroke, although that was true. They had less, they were less likely to have dementia from stroke, but they were less likely to have any kind of dementia. I think it's encouraging and another, it doesn't say for sure that if you exercise, you will not get dementia, but there are lots of reasons to focus on fitness, and this just adds to that piece of it, adds one more reason to exercise.
Christy, I know of someone who has dementia who's in their 70s, but they play basketball 2 and 3 times every week. And their dementia appears to be stable. And now, whether that's because it's just not progressing or because the exercise is helping, we don't know. But the exercise is certainly helping them for heart prevention and maybe for dementia progression. Well, more research to come, but no bad news here.
No. Okay, let's talk about the patient-centered medical home. This has been an effort going on as a way to organize primary care, to focus on quality and patient experience and personal doctoring.
And to be frank about it, virtually every outpatient practice in the United States is thinking about this, moving towards this, adopting this, experiencing with it. For lots of reasons, with the firm belief that it improves the quality of care and it may reduce the cost of care. And then let's also say it, if you can adopt these really stringent reforms, the doctors, the primary care doctors, may actually see a little bit more economic reimbursement. So it could be a win-win-win.
So this was one of those reviews where they looked at lots of different studies. They looked at 19 different studies, and what they found overall was that there was a small effect that they could measure on things like patient experience, the delivery of preventive care services, staff experiences, and a decrease in emergency department visits.
But there wasn't a decrease in hospital admissions, and there was really no evidence that the overall cost of care were decreased. And I think, you know, this was in what's called the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews. We can put it up on our website. Important research to begin this conversation, which is the cost of quality, at least as we practice it in the United States here, isn't cheap. And I'm not so certain that it will decrease the cost of care. I do believe it increases quality.
Well, I think the jury's still out on this, that having organized care delivered in an outpatient setting certainly makes a lot of sense that it can long-term save money, but we'll just have to see. More study is needed.
More study, more research, but hopefully better care.
That's right. Let's talk about CTs. So everyone's been concerned about getting radiation that could lead to cancer from getting CAT scans.
That's that C. And I don't know why is it a T, because it should be a CS.
Yes, yeah. I know. It should be something easy.
We call them CT CAT scans. And unfortunately, if you're a dog lover out there, maybe this is good. But if you're a cat lover, now I'm not going to go there. Okay, CAT scans, those scans that do give radiation.
And so this was a study done by a group at Massachusetts General Hospital looking at CTs in young adults who you would think they're most likely to be susceptible to the ionizing, the radiation that comes, and they're more likely to live long enough that if there was risk coming, and there is risk coming with the radiation, that would affect them.
In addition to which, the CAT scans have increased dramatically in the United States over the last decade. And so the question is, in their study, which was published in the journal Radiology, appropriately called, did the patients, were they indicated, were there benefits for these records from 22,000 patients, many of whom had chest CT scans and then abdomen or in their pelvis, many of whom also had trauma, and that's the reason why they had these scans.
And they followed them for an average of 5.5 years from the time they got the scan, and did find a higher risk of death. 7.1% of young adults who had a chest CT and 3.9% of those who had the belly CT died, compared with the general population, or the risk sort of put out there from related to radiation being 0.1%. All that to say is, yes, their risk of death was higher, but the authors really talk a little bit about what that might mean.
And I think one of the take-home messages is it's not just those who need to get frequent CAT scans who we need to focus our efforts on, perhaps reducing the need for them, but also those who maybe get them infrequently. The new generation of CAT scans are giving less radiation, but it still doesn't mean it's completely safe. Most doctors don't order these unless they really feel they're necessary. But I think in the future, we're going to be talking more and more about, are they really necessary?
I really think if you're a listener out there, that is the take-home message, that think twice about getting a CAT scan. People used to want to get whole-body CAT scans just to know, and that's not a good idea. You want to make sure there's a good reason for it. But in a lot of instances, you need that CAT scan to get appropriate medical treatment. So it's a conversation to always have with your physician.
Yep. Let's talk about our very last research that matters. And this was research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine Journal, Christy. And it was about, are we healthier than our parents? A very interesting kind of question, for which I think I would have said, well, of course we're healthier. We live longer, but that doesn't mean we're healthier.
Yeah, really fascinating. What they did was they took the sets of responses from this National Health and Nutrition Examination survey that was done not that long ago, in 1988 and 1994, and they compared the results of sort of the older adults now with people who are baby boomers who took the same survey in 2007, 2010 to see, okay, at the same age range, what was their picture of health?
Well, and only one out of seven of the baby boomers said their own health was excellent, compared to almost one out of three of the older group. And, the baby boomers were more likely to have things like high blood pressure, high cholesterol,
diabetes,
and even obesity, but they were less likely to have things like smoking, which had decreased substantially. So what do you take of this, Christy?
Well, I think what I, the smoking
First off, were you
part,
born in 1988?
No, but I'm not in either of these two categories. I'm not a baby boomer. But I was encouraged to hear that fewer of the baby boomers are smoking. Fewer of them have emphysema compared with their elder counterparts. But fewer of them exercised, and there was just more all of this obesity-related illness.
Well, yeah, but perhaps 30 or 40 years ago, our parents who were obese, no one told them they were obese.
That's right.
No one told them they had diabetes. No one told them they had high blood pressure. So they may have thought that they were healthier. I'm not so certain they were healthier.
That's true.
My father, bless his memory, he never exercised.
Well, the boomers are larger as a group than their older counterparts. So there's some tie in there. But I think all this just says, we should think about this a little bit and really make sure we're focusing what is health and that we're all focusing our families on health.
It's not just the absence of illness.
That is right.
Well, Christy, we've had a good chance to talk about this question of living longer but also living healthier.
About CAT scans, benefits sometimes outweighing cancer risks.
About this patient-centered medical home. When you hear it's being done in your doctor's offices, ask them, what are they doing? Maybe you can participate in it.
And the possibility that exercise and midlife fitness levels help prevent later life dementia.
Well, we'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with New York Times bestselling writer Ann Fletcher about her book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with New York Times bestselling health and medical writer Ann Fletcher about her new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment, How to Get the Help That Works. Welcome to Your Health, Ann.
Good to be with you.
We're so glad to have you. You know, Ann, I wonder if you might be willing to share a little bit of your story, what led you to write this book and share your insights with the readers.
Well, I previously had written a book about recovery called Sober for Good, and that came out more than 10 years ago, 2001. And that is a book about more than 200 people who had long-term sobriety. They had overcome serious drinking problems and had stayed sober for more than 5 years. And I got interested in that in part because of my own serious drinking problem and having struggled with that and having overcome it in a non-traditional way. I tried AA, but it didn't appeal to me. And having found my own route to sobriety, I got really interested in how other people did it. So I interviewed more than 200 people who had done it in many different ways. And I partly wanted to heighten awareness of the many different routes to sobriety, but also I wanted to see what these people had in common, people who had recovered in many different ways. And so that's how I initially got interested in this subject area.
And then how did you, the subject for this book, which really one might even say you went from the frying pan into the fire, because you've now tackled the whole world of all that much larger group who is seeking and needs to seek treatment.
Yeah, sometimes I ask myself that as I was writing this book, which took almost 5 years. What were you thinking to take on the subject of an entire industry? And believe me, I had to learn all about drug addiction, too, for this book. I already knew from personal experience about serious alcohol problems, but this was learning a lot more. And most addiction treatment programs, rehabs in this country, do tackle both problems. I didn't go to one that didn't tackle both at the same time. I got interested in this because in the course of writing Sober for Good, I got to know one of the leading experts in the country, Dr. Thomas McClellan, who was one of the founders of the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia. And he had started studying addiction treatment programs across the country, and some of his findings were really disturbing. And I just had begun to get to know him when I was writing Sober for Good, and we stayed in touch over the years. We became friends. And he would tell me things like, Ann, the turnover in fast food rehabs and treatment programs is higher than that in fast food restaurants. I mean, addiction counselors, you know, come and go that quickly, and that's not good for patients. He would tell me things like, most of the treatment programs that I'm surveying from my study don't have doctors on board. They don't have psychologists, social workers. They don't have qualified people here treating people with addictions.
So thinking about, for our listeners who may not know, help us understand what is a rehab, what defines a rehab center or addiction treatment?
Well, there really isn't a definition, but I went...
That's a problem.
That is part of the problem, but for the purposes of this book, I went to, there are about almost 14,000 addiction treatment centers in the country. Let me first make a distinction that AA is a self-help group. That's not treatment, okay? That's AA. There are others, Smart Recovery, Women for Sobriety, that a lot of people haven't heard of. Those are support groups for people in the community. They are not treatment. I went to formal treatment programs where you're getting or supposed to be getting professional help, professional treatment. And they include, they're different kinds, but for the most part, there's residential treatment, which is what most of us think of as going to rehab, partly because of what the media tells us. You know, you have a drug problem, you go away to rehab for 30 days. That's where you go away overnight for rehab. But that's only about 10% of treatment in this country. Most of the treatment in this country, 80 to 90% of it, is outpatient treatment, where you are going usually for a couple of hours, a couple times a week. Sometimes it's more intense than that. And then you go home at night. You go back to your regular job. And there's no evidence, actually, that residential treatment, going away to rehab, is any more effective than outpatient treatment. But I visited both types. I went to 15 programs all across the country, everything from celebrity rehabs to high-end 12-step-based residential, famous residential programs, to outpatient programs in rural areas, and even some that treat indigent people. So I really wanted to see it all, and I also interviewed more than 100 people for their recent treatment experiences.
Well, I know we're going to get into a lot of the pearls and some stories, but, you know, it seems like that we have some assumptions we just then have to throw out the window. We flush down the toilet. I mean, if we would think that more is better here, more intensity, more time is better, but you're saying that's not the case. Why is that?
Well, more time is better, but not smashed into a month. More time in terms of spread out over years. We now know that serious substance problems really are viewed as chronic disorders. Many people call them diseases that are best viewed like diabetes or heart disease that need to be treated over years, not in a 30-day treatment program or even a 90-day treatment program. They're problems that tend to wax and wane, go in and out of remission. And many, many experts believe that a long-term chronic care model is what we need for addiction. There is no evidence, as one expert, Dr. Mark Willenbring, who used to be the director of treatment for the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, said there's no evidence supporting a short-term intensive burst of treatment, which is the classic 30-day rehab model, where you just go away, you're removed from reality and all the temptations that lead you back to drinking again. You go away and you go back to your regular life, and your family expects you to be fixed.
Well, I think the reframing of for the family and for the patient of thinking of it long-term is probably hard for people to swallow, but at the same time important that it's not like you go and get fixed.
Yes.
You talk in your book about what it's like. Tell us or give us a picture or two of what a rehab is like from a patient perspective.
Well, that's one of the things I do in the beginning of every chapter is tell somebody's story from start to finish. And some of the stories aren't finished. This is one of the, you know, in all of my books, I tell people's stories. And this is one for which I really got to follow people sometimes for years. I would meet them at some of the rehabs. the first part of writing this book was visiting the programs, and I would meet people there and then follow them through for years as I was writing the book. Some of them as they relapsed and went to in and out of rehab. Some of them got better and continued on in their lives. So it was really, I was really honored to continue to be part of their lives.
And you talk about Paul's story. Is he one of these people?
Paul, you're going to have to help me with the last chapter.
Yes.
Oh, he was one of the saddest stories. You have to remember that I use pseudonyms in the book, so they chose their pseudonyms. So I might actually know him by a different name in my head.
Confusing.
But yeah, his story really stood out because when his treatment program referred him to me toward the end of the book, I said to the treatment director, "Oh, not another story. I have enough stories for the book." And the head of the program said, "Well, you're going to want to talk to this guy because he really has quite a story to tell." And when I heard it, I had to tell it for the last chapter of the book because it was heartbreaking. He had been to more than 20 different treatment programs. His family and he had spent more than $500,000.
Wow.
And I had too many stories like this. And sadly, with this disorder, addiction, more than any other disorder, people are blamed when the treatment fails. And they're not offered something different. You know, with heart disease, if your stent or your bypass or your angioplasty doesn't work or your medication, the doctor switches to something different. In addiction treatment, I heard over and over again that people would go back to programs and be offered the same thing over and over again, 12 steps, the disease model. They would never be told about other kinds of approaches that are out there that we know are effective for addiction treatment. And he was one of them. The 12-step model just didn't work for him. His psychological problems were not addressed in the treatment programs he went to until he finally got to this last program. But a lot of damage had been done in the meantime, and it was extremely heartbreaking.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, let's get right into there. There's some wonderful tips and other ideas that really, I think, challenge that status quo. And I think you have a quote there about, says in the beginning of the book, that just because it's written in stone, it doesn't mean it cannot change. And I know you've got some great change tips. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, medical writer Ann Fletcher, about her new book, Inside Rehab. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with New York Times bestselling health and medical writer Ann Fletcher about her new book, Inside Rehab, The Surprising Truth About Addiction Treatment. And Ann, in the first segment, you were talking about a shift in paradigm of addiction being more of a chronic disorder over time that needs treatment versus something that there's a quick fix for. And you talked a little bit about the problems and the variation of these rehab programs, but we were hoping you've gleaned and would share with us a little bit of your tips about what rehab should look like. What kind of hope is there for our listeners?
Well, first of all, it's important for people to understand that most people with substance use disorders, which is the fancy name that, you know, the correct name for drug and alcohol problems, substance use disorders, drug and alcohol problems, fall on a large continuum. And rehabs and outpatient and residential programs are really designed for people with the most severe problems. And they really represent the minority of people with substance problems. Most people with particularly with alcohol problems, have mild to moderate problems. And we have no place for those people to get help. Now, there are experts who are working on this. The Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, is going to be addressing this and for the first time allowing healthcare professionals, primary care providers, to get reimbursed to actually provide treatment. Now we've got to find the time and the training for them to be able to do that. but I was one of those people who had a more mild to moderate kind of alcohol problem, and there was nowhere for me to get help. But I do offer some suggestions in the book. You know, let me just back up. The people like that, they're people who are what we call functioning alcoholics. They're sitting next to you at work. They're sitting next to you at church. They're going about their lives, not albeit, you know, not in the most optimal way. But they're not your falling down drunks and hardcore addicts. That's most people with substance problems. I have a section in the book where I give all kinds of guidelines about how to find, as you were alluding to, suggestions for finding a quality treatment program. And a lot of the advice comes from these people who have been through rehab many, many times. I tell the story of one woman who developed her own treatment shopping checklist, and she had all kinds of advice. The guy, Paul, who we talked about previously, who had been to rehab 20 times, wonderful advice. He said, ask questions like, if I'm there for a week and I decide I don't want to stay, I don't like the place, or they're not flexible, can I get my money back? I had people who paid for an entire month of treatment, and they had to leave for some reason, or they wanted to leave, and they couldn't get any of their money back. So important questions to ask like that. But don't assume that if somebody has a drug or alcohol problem, they need to go to rehab. There's a whole chapter in the book about who needs to go to rehab, stories of many people who recovered without going to rehab. In fact, most people overcome substance problems without ever setting foot in a rehab. You know, individual counseling with a psychologist, psychiatrist, some kind of mental health professional who has specialty training with addictions. That's how I did it. And I talk, I have a whole section of how you can find people, the different, like, social workers, psychologists, and different kinds of physicians, and how you find somebody with specialty training in that area.
Well, one of the tips that you have from those whom you interviewed was you really need to be a really wise consumer. You need to be able to ask questions. But I would wonder that sometimes people who have substance abuse addictions, that's part of the problem. It's difficult sometimes to think clearly enough. How does do you become an advocate? Do you recruit an advocate to really work with you to help understand? Because you need expertise and you need a clear mind.
It is hard, you know, and it's important that, you know, it's the decision to go to rehab is often made in crisis mode. And so that's why you need to have family members, loved ones involved. But unless a person is really, you know, again, it's the minority who are in that really, really severe mode where they have to go to detox. But even in that situation, one thing that you could consider doing, and I give different ways of doing it, is try to get an independent assessment. I mean, I even describe, and this is coming, I interviewed many, many experts, that you could even go have your detox done in an outpatient way, and I have an expert who gives guidelines for doing that. If you go to a rehab, if you go to even to an outpatient program for an assessment, I was just contacted, I'll give you an example, by a young 20-something person and who I know the family. And from what I was told about her, I haven't connected with her yet, but my guess is it doesn't sound like she's probably a candidate for an addiction treatment program. But I can guarantee you that if she contacts one where I live, they're going to admit her. And that typically happens. And I explain, there's a whole section on assessment, because typically when you contact programs, you end up being admitted. I encourage people to get an independent assessment from an expert, somebody who has some expertise. I can think of a number of professionals in my small university town of about 50,000 people who are mental health professionals who have expertise with addictions, who could give you an independent assessment to tell you whether or not you need outpatient, residential, or maybe no treatment at all.
Maybe
it's not always necessary.
Maybe you could just see your primary care physician.
Yes, to be managed for detox, and then go to a program of your choosing.
And so where is the best place to start? A family or an individual, you know, comes to this place to say, okay, I need help with this. And so do they start with their primary care doctor? Do they go to their local? I know every state and area is different, but where's the best place to start, in your opinion?
It really is so individual that it's hard to give a one best place to start. You know, ideally, you know, you're doing something about a problem before it gets really bad. I think one of the problems is that we're often told you have to hit bottom, you know, that we look for the signs and symptoms of somebody having a problem and a struggle before it gets really severe, to start doing homework even before a person shows signs of readiness to change. I talk a lot about, in the book, there's a lot of the discussion is about the gap between science and practice. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we know are effective for addiction treatment that don't go on in practice. And one of them is family members are often sent to Al-Anon, which is great for family support, but it tends to tell you you can't do much of anything for the person who has the addiction, and that's actually not true. There is a science-based approach called CRAFT, which is an acronym, and I'm going to give a book that suggests, that's not my book, that is helpful to people, but this is a start for how you can communicate with a person who has a substance problem to help move them to readiness. Despite what you've been told, you can't do anything to get a person to move toward readiness to get treatment or go to rehab. The book is called Get Your Loved One Sober.
That's Get Your Loved One Sober
by Dr. Robert Myers. I think he's now emeritus, but he was at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Robert Myers and Brenda Wolfe. It's published by Hazelden. But not well publicized, and Get Your Loved One Sober, it gives you communication strategies for helping to move that loved one toward readiness to change, to do something, to get ready. And actually about 5 randomized controlled trials have been done with the CRAFT approach, which is what the book uses. It's called Community Reinforcement and Family Training. Which treatment professionals are now being trained across the country, but not as I found one of the 15 programs that I visited was using this approach tell you how behind the times programs tend to be. But
Ann,
yes, we're running out of time.
we're getting close, and I just want to have maybe one final question for you,
yes.
Which is, it seems as if throughout your book and the advice and listening to you that you really talk about finding those who have expertise and that these people are out there and not assume that the person you're talking to is uniquely qualified. Is that a take-home message here, that there is hope, but you've got to find someone who really knows what they're doing?
Ask questions. So many people who I interviewed, I would say, well, what were the credentials of your counselor? And they didn't know. They just made assumptions. And sadly, a big survey that was done by a group called Casa Columbia recently showed that more than half of states do not require even a bachelor's degree for an addiction counselor. And that's who provides the most of the care in addiction treatment programs. A minimum of a master's degree should be required, say the experts, as it is for other mental health disorders. So ask about credentials. Ask what percentage of time will I spend in individual versus group counseling, because everything's done in groups, and that's not good for everybody.
Well, thank you for making the effort to write these two books. And I imagine our listeners who want to read your book, Inside Rehab, could look it up on Amazon or Google.
Yes, it's available on online retailers. I have a website, www.annmfletcher.com, and I also have a blog on Psychology Today called Inside Rehab.
Well, we'll make links to all of those, and we really want to thank you for taking us inside of rehab, but also opening the door to the listeners and perhaps really starting a conversation, which is so critical to our children, to our families, to our patients, to the American public.
Well, and the good news is that there really are people who get better, and there are so many good, well-intentioned people who really do want to help.
Well, we want to thank Ann Fletcher again for her book, Inside Rehab. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question or a concern, or really want to talk to us about anything, you can send us your comments at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to answer your questions. And let's go right to our house call questions today from listeners.
Let's take our first house call now.
My mother was told by her doctor recently that she may have hemochromatosis. She had some heart problems, and the tests show too much iron in her body. How does too much iron cause heart problems?
She may have hemochromatosis. That is a fancy word that actually sounds scary and can be.
Well, and I'll just ask right now, we'll ask our really smart health sciences librarians to put up a link about what is hemochromatosis.
And spell it right, too.
Exactly. That's hard to do.
But it's hemo, which is the iron. And I'm not sure what the chromatosis piece is, but we know that this is iron that gets deposited, excess iron in the blood that gets deposited in every potential tissue in the body. And it's actually one of the most common inherited diseases.
And it can cause heart problems. It can cause lots of different problems because of those iron deposits in the different tissues of the body.
Yeah, it used to be that one out of six patients that presented to the doctor's office with hemochromatosis presented with some sort of heart problem because they had a little bit of excess iron that was deposited in the heart and it caused some scarring, and then they would have problems with arrhythmias or different rates of their heart beating fast and slow, and some of them would need pacemakers. And it's a hard disease to sometimes diagnose because you have to do a special test frequently, which is testing for how much iron is in the body, which isn't one of the first tests we normally think about.
Hopefully, your mom will have good progress and some answers from your doctor, and would encourage you to go over this specifically with her tests and just hope that her heart remains strong every time.
And you and any of the family, if she does have hemochromatosis, will need to be tested because this is preventable by actually taking iron out, by doing taking blood out of the body and reducing the iron load. You can actually prevent the problems like the heart, cirrhosis, scarring of the liver, diabetes, all kinds of problems. Thank you so much for a great question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have severe high blood pressure, and I am already on 3 medications. It's much better, but it is still too high according to my doctor, who said he wants me to take a 4th medication. That seems like too much to me, and I am scared that a 4th medication will be worse than living with a slightly high blood pressure. What do you think?
Wow, this is a tough one, Christy.
This is a tough one. And on the one hand, most people who have high blood pressure require more than one blood pressure medicine to bring it down, to the point that the recommendations are changing now. So we often start people on more than one medication. So it's not unusual to need more than one. But once you're in the 4 range, you want to start thinking, maybe there's something else going on causing that high blood pressure, and maybe a bigger evaluation should be done.
Yeah, that's right, Christy. The flip side of one sometimes doesn't do it is, wow, if you got to go to 4, that is a lot. But the reality is, actually, the guidelines say you really sometimes need to do that for people who have really severe high blood pressure. I kind of feel like maybe that sometimes is the time where I really would like a consult from one of my blood pressure specialty colleagues, called a nephrologist at times, just to help me figure out, because sometimes it's really difficult. There are rare and sometimes not so rare conditions that can cause this that are treated differently than just medication.
It's true. Sometimes we'll get an ultrasound, or there's a way to look at the blood flow through the blood vessels to the kidney, and that can sometimes have a blockage there that causes problems. So there are other tests just of your blood and of your urine that can be done to look for anything else going on in your body causing that blood pressure to be that stubborn.
I know I've got a patient, Christy, that we're thinking about whether or not we should go to a 4th medication now. And, you know, it may be that being on that 4th medication to lower the blood pressure, particularly when there's a history of strokes in the family, is actually better and safer. On the other hand, maybe we can do some things like losing 20 pounds that may actually also bring that blood pressure down into that area. So let's not forget the baby with
both.
The bathwater. Yep, absolutely. We need to do both. Thank you for a really good question. We hope our answer has at least started us on that, giving you some answers.
Let's take our next house call question. Interesting question.
I recently quit smoking marijuana and started smoking cigarettes. I think much more clearly and feel better overall. I know I should stop smoking cigarettes, but I am scared I will start smoking marijuana again. What ideas do you have?
I know. Well, it makes me want to sigh, too. The answer is the best thing to do is stop both. And then there are different problems you could have by continuing to smoke marijuana by way of your thinking, as you mentioned, problems with the law, because it's not illegal at this point. And you know, problem being functional and working and those types of things if you're high.
And we're congratulating you. You quit smoking marijuana, and that is, and frequently for many young people and even older people, is addictive. And, you know, you are feeling better. The problem is you started in on one of the, if not the most addictive substance. Mm-hmm. And so you're dealing with the problem of addiction. And we're, with our great guest today, we were talking all about addiction today. And so our philosophy is going to be, let's get you off the things that you're addicted to. And there's some mm-hmm. great medicines that can help you, because you might need some help now getting off the cigarettes too, without going back to the marijuana.
And, you know, I think the programs that can help you quit smoking cigarettes could help you with both. There are very successful programs. Of course, I'm looking at Adam, who leads the Nicotine Independence Clinic at UNC, and it's very successful in helping people quit and stay off cigarettes.
Matter of fact, we'll ask our health sciences librarians to put up some information about our nicotine dependence program, remind people that we actually do work with clients who are interested in quitting smoking and sometimes who are duly addicted both to alcohol and sometimes to marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the question. Good luck moving forward. Let's listen to our very last house call.
I have heard of migraines and I have heard of vertigo, but my doctor told me I have migraine vertigo. Did he just make this up or is it real?
Well, we have heard of migraines and we have heard of vertigo, and your doctor says that you've got migraine vertigo. It's true. He's not making it up.
Well, I would say, it is unusual. It's not just a common thing that everybody with migraines gets that room spinning feeling or that vertigo. But you can have migraines that change different parts of your nerves. So it can change your vision, or it can change your sensitivity to light. Some people feel nauseous, and it could cause you to have some like room spinning kind of dizzy feeling.
We call that vestibular migraine. We like to give a fancy medical title to common things like migraine and dizziness, but it is a well-described phenomena. And I think your doctor is actually doing good, because they're perhaps linking up two different things, and rather than giving you two, three, four different medicines, maybe they can find one medicine that really helps you, or find some non-medical treatments that can deal with both of these things, rather than seeing you as two separate medical problems.
You do want to make sure your doctor's thinking of other possibilities, because they could be two separate things. But it certainly is a phenomenon. You ask, is it real? It is real as a possibility. So keep working with that doctor, and hopefully you guys will come up with a good treatment plan.
Well, Christy, that'll conclude our house calls today. We hope that we've addressed issues that are important to everyone's health, and our listeners can send us their stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Ann Fletcher. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we can't wait to talk with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.